Mutiny Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from the studios at WVOX in New Rochelle, the Queen City. Located on the Long Island Sound, it can also be heard streaming live at WVOX.com worldwide. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guests are historians and professors Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman. Our subject is their new book, FDR and the Jews, and their evaluation of FDR's record regarding immigration, the Holocaust, isolationism, the bombing of Auschwitz, the War Refugee Board, and Yalta and Palestine. Welcome, gentlemen, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Certainly, the issue of immigration, refugee, and toleration is always with us. Over the past 7 years, I've devoted 27 programs to FDR, the New Deal, Eleanor Roosevelt, Social Security, Civilian Conservation Corps, WPA, and immigration is always one of the most hot-button radioactive issues in this country. Richard Brightman is the author or co-author of 10 books and many articles in German history, U.S. history, and the Holocaust. He's the distinguished professor at American University. He's also the editor of the journal Holocaust and Genocide Studies. He served as the director of historical research for the Nazi War Criminal Records and the Imperial Japanese Records Interagency Working Group. Incredible amount of documentation he has found. He was the lead editor of two volumes of the diaries and papers of James McDonald, who was FDR's chairman of his advisory committee on political refugees. He received his BA at Yale in 1969, graduated with honors and in distinction in history and political science, and received his MA and PhD in history from Harvard. He teaches, of course, at American University as editor, as I said, of the Journal of Holocaust and Genocidal Studies. He is the co-author of FDR and the Jews with Professor Alan J. Lichtman, distinguished professor, that is. He's the product of more than 25 years of research and thinking about FDR. He's a native New Yorker. He received his bachelor's degree from Brandeis in 1967, was up in Boston about the same time I was, exactly, graduated Phi Beta Kappa and Magna Cum Laude while running track and wrestling for the school, must have known Henry Littlefield over at Amherst. He received his PhD from Harvard University, and he's the rising to the chair of the history department, and he's been the scholar professor of the year going back to 1993. He's received numerous awards at American University during his career. He is the author or co-author of 6 books and more than 100 articles. He's best known for the keys system presented in his books, The 13 Keys to the Presidencies and the Keys to the White House. Gentlemen, in the last chapter of your book, you wrote, in a retrospective on FDR published 2 weeks after his death, Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, a close friend of FDR, insightfully wrote that contemporaries no less than later generations have a claim on the legacy of world leaders. I quote, fluctuations of historic judgment are the lot of great men, and Roosevelt will not escape it. But if history has its claim, so has the present, for it has been wisely said that if the judgment of time must be corrected by that of posterity, it is no less true that the judgment of posterity must be corrected by that of time. Basically saying that one has to be judged in their time. Also, FDR, as he was known by everyone in his time, was one of the most complex men to hold office. He was also one of the most secretive, and in the description of the great historian, James McGregor Burns, was almost exactly what Machiavelli described the prince as, having to be the lion and the fox. When FDR was sworn into office on March 4th, 1933, America was in the throes of the Great Depression. Adolf Hitler had become Chancellor of Germany on January 30th, approximately 35 days before. Hitler had made it clear for over a decade his views on the Jews of Germany and what his actions would be. Therefore, gentlemen, could you tell us how America, FDR, and the Jewish community viewed this threat?
Well, there is no question that FDR knew what Hitler was and what his horrific policies were towards Jews. He despised Hitler and everything he stood for. Nonetheless, during his first term, this was one of the most minimal periods with respect to any response by FDR to the persecution of Jews. We show in our book that FDR's response was not monolithic during his 12-plus years as presidency, that in fact four different Roosevelts emerged with different degrees of activism. The first Roosevelt was not very active. He had other higher priorities. And this is another lesson of our book. A president's not a dictator. He can do a lot, but he also has to deal with many, many different priorities. He has and to deal with the public, the Congress, his own bureaucracy. FDR's priorities during his first term were quite clear.
Now, how was the Jewish view of this threat universally in America?
Well, the Jews were certainly very much aware of this threat, but they were divided. You know, there's an old saying, where there are two Jews, there are three opinions.
Right.
And the more militant group, headed by Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, the American Jewish Congress, organized demonstrations and protests against the persecution of the Jews to publicize it and to try to move the administration to admit more Jewish refugees or to take a stand against Hitler. The other group, the more conservative, more elitist group, the American Jewish Committee, headed by Cyrus Adler, was also aware of the threats, but opposed these protests and rallies and tried to discourage Stephen Wise from holding them and discourage people from attending them. They wanted to rely on quiet, behind-the-scenes diplomacy and believe that these protests were too provocative. Well, Roosevelt, meanwhile, is fighting this horrific depression with nearly 25% unemployment, businesses and farms in the red, real GDP dropping by 30% since the beginning of the Depression. He's trying to institute some of the most audacious reforms in the history of the country, and he's aware of a resurgent Germany that wants to keep the peace. He never wants his New Deal programs to have the appearance of minority programs. He doesn't want to rub raw ethnic antagonism in the United States at a time of very widespread, although not virulent, anti-Semitism like there was.
Now let me jump in on this. In 1932, for the first time in American history, more people left the United States than immigrated to our shores. Xenophobia was rife. Strict immigration laws of 1924 were in full force, based on 1880 national origin census and before the second great immigration, and anti-Semitism was on the rise. Germans were the largest minority group in America in 1930. Did the rise of German nationalism and anti-Semitism affect the large group of German Americans who were still trying to live down the stigma of World War One, and was there the backlash against anything German? Was that part of the equation that we were facing here?
Not a whole lot. The Germans were not particularly active at this time with respect to this issue one way or another, although the German-American Bund developed a little bit later on and did have a very small but very fervent kind of following. But certainly the presence of widespread anti-Semitism was very important. Here's what we learned, that often it is the fear of anti-Semitism, the worry about anti-Semitism, that's worse than the reality of anti-Semitism, and that can paralyze even the most well-meaning of leaders. And here's FDR at this time of anti-Semitism, trying to fight the Depression, adopt the New Deal, build his Democratic Party, and keep world peace, and he does little or nothing either to ease the visa restrictions put in by Herbert Hoover that, as you describe, really reduce immigration not just from Germany but everywhere to a trickle, does not openly denounce Nazi Germany, and does not at this point try to organize democratic nations against it.
Let me jump in on this. This is Richard Breitman.
Right, Richard.
The American Jewish community was divided organizationally and to some extent politically. Most of the Jewish organizations recognized the threat that Nazi Germany posed to German Jews. But some of them felt that the level of anti-Semitism and the level of just danger from the Depression was so high in the United States that it was better to organize protests or politicking on a broad basis, on the basis that the Nazis were not simply threatening Jews, but they were threatening civilization, they were threatening political liberties. And so,
Professor Brightman, I have to go to a break. We're going to get back to this after the break.
Okay.
We have to go to a short financial news flash. You're listening to The Advocates, WVOX 1460, live streaming on WVOX.com. I'm with my guests, historians Richard Brightman, Alan Lichtman, authors, professors about FDR and the Jews. We'll be back in a moment.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, the latest minutes from the Federal Reserve sparking a major rally on Wall Street. Both the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500 hitting new lifetime highs at 12 p.m. Eastern. The Dow's up 118 points. The Postal Service is giving up on its plan to end Saturday service after encountering resistance from Congress. The agency says Congress gave it no choice by prohibiting the implementation of a new postal delivery schedule. Italian cruise line Costa agreeing to pay a $1.3 million fine over last year's Concordia disaster. Costa was under investigation for the deadly accident that off the coast of Italy, killing 32 people. Costa is a unit of Carnival Corporation. And New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Arts is getting a $1 billion collection. Philanthropist and cosmetic tycoon Leonard Lauder is donating 78 cubist works, including pieces from Pablo Picasso. The collection is expected to go on display next fall. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Lauren Simonetti.
Lou Dobbs, Neil Cavuto. They're the biggest players in business news. First,
stocks snapping a four-day losing streak.
Getting insight behind every sector.
What would it take to get people buying houses again?
Smart, trusted, experienced. Then, over three decades in the business.
Gathering outside the New York Stock Exchange.
On the ground.
Almost 1,000 points.
Breaking news.
It's the biggest in U.S. history.
Covering it all.
Government shutdown.
That's why he is the first and last name in business. Weeknights. Watch Lou Dobbs tonight at 7, followed by Cavuto at 8 on Fox Business.
You've been cooped up all winter.
Go to the window, open it.
Smell that fresh air.
Experience the excitement of spring with WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guests, Professor Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman from American University. We've been discussing their book, FDR and the Jews and His Initiatives. Before we went to our first break, Professor Brightman was discussing some of the reaction of Jewish Americans in the country and the situation. Just to preface this, FDR enjoyed great support from the Jewish community. More than 15% of his high appointments were of Jews, and he appointed in total more Jews to government than all his 31 predecessors and all who followed until Bill Clinton. In the Bronx, as an example, the most heavily Jewish county in the United States, he received almost 95% of the vote. Go on what you were saying about the state of Jewish opinion and Jewry in America in the 1930s? And did they have a lot of influence? Were they well-off, lower-middle-class, Professor Brightman?
The American Jewish Committee was an elitist organization, tended to be highly educated and wealthy Jews of German origin. The American Jewish Congress had much more of an Eastern European base, even though Wise himself was very well educated and assimilated, Rabbi Stephen Wise. The problem that Roosevelt faced in his first term is kind of ironic given some of the attitudes about FDR and the Jews today. He was attacked as being too close to the Jews. In fact, his New Deal programs were sometimes described as Jewish radicalism. Mm. And so given a choice between describing the Nazis as a threat to the Jews or as a threat to the West, Roosevelt preferred the latter.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. My parents were married by Stephen Weiss on June 16th, 1935, and my mother was a vice president of the state chapter of the American Jewish Congress, interestingly enough. You know, in your book, you write that, and of course you've already articulated that FDR's first term, he focused little on international affairs, essentially because of the economic crisis at hand. In his second term, with his massive victory over Governor Alf Landon of Kansas and the acceleration of Nazi persecution of Germany's Jews, there was more pressure on FDR and America Act. What were the initiatives by American FDR in immigration, and was there any pressure on Germany? And where was the resistance centered against this pressure as the new second term evolved?
Very important. Everything changes after Roosevelt's reelection in 1936. Remember, he wasn't thinking at that point about running for a third term. No American had ever served more than two terms as president, following the George Washington tradition. And he fundamentally changes immigration policy. He couldn't change the quotas that, as you point out, had been put into effect in 1924. Only Congress could do that. And as his vice president, John Ansgar Garner, said, if Congress could vote in secret, they'd probably eliminate all quotas and allow no immigrants. So he couldn't go to Congress. But by executive action, he eased the very strict requirements that his predecessor, Herbert Hoover, had put into effect to make it very difficult to get visas, which were essential to immigration. It was a requirement. As a result, many tens of thousands of additional Jewish refugees were able to make it to the United States. And for the first time during his second term, the quota gets filled. In addition, he lets 10 to 15,000 Jewish refugees in the United States who are on temporary visas indefinitely. He also pressures Latin American countries, including Cuba. The famous episode everyone knows about is the St. Louis, the ship that was turned away from Cuba. Well, 5 to 6,000 Jewish refugees, as a result of FDR's initiatives, had gotten to Cuba. Some 40,000 got to Latin America. And he organized the Evian Conference, a worldwide conference for the resettlement of Jewish refugees. It didn't work, but it didn't work because the world was not willing to take in Jews. He pressured Britain on Palestine. Again, he couldn't stop the British from sharply restricting Jewish immigration to Palestine, but he did pressure them, although he's obviously not willing to have a breach in relations with Americans' most important allies. A lot of these initiatives were resisted at home. The public was very much opposed, overwhelmingly, to letting in additional immigrants. The Congress was very much isolationist and very much restrictionist. And none of these initiatives benefited him politically. As you say, he already had the Jewish vote.
Right.
They were not going to turn against him. And he was risking antagonizing the isolationists and the restrictionists at a time when he was fighting internal battles against conservatives in his own party, facing the economic downturn of 1938 and a very, very difficult midterm election in which Republicans made major gains. So he wasn't doing these things for political gain.
Right. And just as a, before you go on, just as a corollary to this, Adolph Sabbath and Emanuel Seller, two congressmen, one from Chicago, one from New York. Most New Yorkers of a certain age are familiar with Seller, who served for over 50 years, sponsored a bill, put forward a bill to double the quotas. They were told by Southern Dixiecrats and isolationists and anti-immigration foe, exactly what you said. If you continue pushing this bill, we will eliminate the quotas. Very interesting commentary on that. You know, because this is such a vast subject and we have limits of time and moving forward on the eve of World War II, most people never imagined that there'd be a Holocaust. Most European Jews thought that Germany only wanted to get rid of its Jews. And a significant number of Germany's 500,000 Jews started to immigrate to the United States, other countries in Europe, along with Palestine, Cuba, South America. One incident that grabbed world attention you just mentioned was the voyage of the German ocean liner St. Louis and its 937 refugee Jewish passengers. What happened to the St. Louis, its passengers, and why did Cuba and the U.S. reject these people?
Okay, we got to go back to November 1938 when Roosevelt met with Colonel Batista, the strongman of Cuba, in the Oval Office. It happened to be 2 days after the Night of Broken Glass,
right,
the famous Nazi pogrom. We don't have a record of what they said in that meeting, but we do know that Batista shortly afterwards went to New York and gave a speech in which he said he was pleased to be cooperating with President Roosevelt in his plan to do something about the refugees from Central Europe. And so what happened? From November 1938 until May 1939, ship after ship of German and Austrian Jews left Germany and went to Cuba, with the passengers mostly having tourist visas. And there was an arrangement that the Joint Distribution Committee would take care of them while they stayed in Cuba as long-term tourists, waiting for their turn to come to immigrate to the United States. There was a big waiting list, because at this point the quota was already filled, and Congress was in no mood to expand the quota. So this was an awkward but rather effective solution for 5,000 to 6,000 German and Austrian Jews.
Yeah, let me go to a break. We're going to finish this. I want to find more about this in a second. We have to go to a commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates with my guests, Richard Brightman, Alan Lichtman. We're talking about immigration, their book, FDR and the Jews. They're discussing their balanced view of FDR's wartime legacy regarding the Holocaust. We'll be back in a moment.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. More background checks are included in a compromise plan in the Senate on gun control.
The bipartisan solution is a lasting solution.
West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin working with Pennsylvania Republican Patrick Toomey.
If expanding background checks to include gun shows and internet sales can reduce the likelihood of criminals and mentally ill people from getting guns, and we can do it in a fashion that does not infringe on the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens, then we should do it.
There'd be no checks on private, no-profit transactions like giving a gun to a relative. A hermit believed to have been living in the central Maine woods for 27 years is arrested stealing food from a camp. Christopher Knight, 47 years old, says he's committed hundreds of small burglaries to survive, told the arresting officer he was the second person he'd spoken to since 1986. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Design. Good functional architectural design. Close to home. Close to you. There are many architectural firms, including the high-profiled, high-priced ones in the city, but in recent years, some very bright ones have moved to the suburbs. It's difficult at best to figure out which architect and designer is best suited for your particular needs. We recommend the architectural firm of William O'Neill. Based in Katona, New York, in northern Westchester, William O'Neill Architects is a full-service firm specializing in distinctive country homes, residential improvement, and retail and industrial rehabilitation. William O'Neill's classic, tasteful architecture is everywhere apparent in our area. They've done lovely homes and apartments, and even a church, among other tasteful and appropriate structures. For a no-cost, no-obligation consultation by William O'Neill himself, we invite you to call William O'Neill Architects based in Katona at 914-232-9493. Classic, tasteful architecture at an affordable price is closer than you think. William O'Neill Architects in Katona, 914-232-9493.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
A mix of clouds and sun giving way to more cloud cover through the afternoon hours, and there's a slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm. Our highs, middle to upper 70s, cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight tonight, lows in the upper 40s. Cloudy, occasional light rain and drizzle, daytime on Thursday. Thursday's highs, mid-50s, and at night, a chance of some rain and drizzle during the evening hours. A steady rain develops overnight, nighttime lows in the lower 40s. Rain and isolated thunderstorms on Friday morning, tapering off to showers in the afternoon, mid-50s, clearing for the weekend. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
Spring is in the air.
It's my favorite time of year.
And your favorite station is keeping it fun.
Just fun to listen to.
WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guests, Professors Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman. We've been discussing their book, FDR and the Jews, their view of FDR's wartime legacy regarding the Holocaust, immigration, isolationists, and potential rescue of thousands of Jews. Right before our break, we were discussing the hot button issue of the St. Louis. What happened to these passengers on the St. Louis? Did they go back to Germany?
They did not go back to Germany. 22 of the passengers on the St. Louis were able to land in Cuba because they had Cuban immigration visas and not the tourist visas. The rest of the passengers, the captain of the ship sailed around waiting for something to happen, sailed near the southern coast of the United States. There is a long-running account that stems from some of the perceptions of the time that the Coast Guard tried to prevent them from landing, and we need to comment on that. Even if they had landed, they had no visas. They could not stay in the United States. The quota was filled. They were on a waiting list. The whole notion was that they wanted to go somewhere so they could wait for their turn to get into the United States. Moreover, the Coast Guard was tracking them not to keep them out of the United States, which was superfluous, but to know where they were so that once negotiations produced a solution, they could tell the captain where to go. And negotiations did produce a solution. The passengers went back to Europe and were taken by the British, the French, the Dutch, and the Belgians. And so in the summer of 1939, this is before the war, this is before the Holocaust, this was a perfectly good solution. It only became bad for about a third of the passengers later after the Nazis conquered several countries in Western Europe. Right. But not a single passenger went back to Germany.
Right. You know, in the period right before World War II, the British issued a white paper on Palestine, which dramatically affected the Balfour decision, their position on Jewish immigration, which called for a potential homeland for Jews and their relationship with the Arab world. What was Churchill's view on Zionism, the white paper, and how did FDR react to this change in policy?
Well, before I get to that, let me add one last coda to the story of the St. Louis that's very important and ties into your question. This is June of 1939. War is on the horizon. FDR's overwhelming priority is to ease the very restrictive neutrality acts that would tie his hands in the event of war and adopt a program of major aid to the Allies. He knew that if he violated the quota laws and let these passengers into the U.S., he would antagonize all the isolationists and all the restrictionists in Congress, and perhaps we never would have gotten the Lend-Lease program that likely saved Britain and saved Russia from being conquered by Germany. Imagine if that had happened. Germans would have slaughtered all the Jews in Palestine, because they all also would have taken Egypt, and millions of Jews in Russia. In that case, FDR would be judged a lot more harshly.
And just as a corollary again to that, when FDR proposed, you talk about that, and we're going to talk about the Wagner-Rogers bill, the Southern delegation opposed it. Senators and congressmen, 0 to 228, they were the heart of the Democratic Party, and Lend-Lease they supported, as you mentioned, 228 to 0, and that didn't pass by a lot either. What was Churchill's view on Zionism? And
I'll let
as
Richard
I said,
take that.
Churchill frequently proclaimed that he was a Zionist. Of course, Churchill didn't come into office until 1940. The Chamberlain government issued a restrictive white paper before the war. Churchill's government, however, maintained the white paper restrictions, and in fact, because of security concern, the white paper quotas were not even filled during the war. So, in theory, Churchill was supportive of Jewish immigration to Palestine. In practice, it didn't work out
under
Churchill's government.
And FDR protested quite often, as you note, about the restrictions.
He never supported the white paper and was always in favor of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Of course, he would also had to tell the Arabs, I'm going to consult with you as well before any final decision is going to be made.
Now, another hot button item, Wagner-Rogers bill, which would sponsor the admission of 20,000 refugee children, which was, and they didn't mention Jews, there was Catholics, there were others. It was eventually withdrawn. What happened to that bill, And why did FDR write NA, no action? And is that because they knew it was dead on arrival?
It was dead on arrival. Simply put, overwhelmingly, by huge margins, the American public opposed any increased immigration of refugees into the United States, even the immigration of children. Right. In fact, some anti-Semites said it's worse to let children in because they're going to multiply. Right. Let old Jews in, you know, who don't have a long lifespan. And the Congress, as we talked about, was very restrictionist, very isolationist, and it didn't have majority support in the Congress either, again at a time when FDR is looking to fundamentally reshift American foreign policy in light of increasing Nazi aggression. He did not believe that he should go out in front on this bill, which was doomed by congressional and public opinion anyway.
And
some of the people that liberals and Jewish advocates thought were going to be sympathetic to such a bill turned out not to be sympathetic. Myron Taylor didn't want to support it. Tom Dewey did not want to support it. So this was really controversial at the time.
Right.
And Roosevelt thought there was going to be a price to pay on the Neutrality Act legislation.
Right. And, of course, later on there was a bill to admit British orphan children, and that passed almost unanimously without comment, which is very interesting, a comment on how people view certain types of immigration. We also know that Northern Democratic Labor opposed opening doors to immigration for competition. So it wasn't only Southern Democrats. We know it was Dixiecrats. We know it was Northern Republican isolationists, etc. Now, as World War II raged, oil politics in the Middle East started to emerge exponentially. State and War Department anti-Jewish interests started to stress the threat that Zionism would affect our war aims. You devote quite a bit of space on this. Could you elaborate on that issue about McCloy, Murray, and others?
Sure. You have to remember how the war proceeded and the plan which they carried out to invade Axis territory was through North Africa, where, of course, many tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Muslims lived. And so the State Department view, both short-term and long-term, was that American interest lay on the side of the Arabs in the Middle East, and that Zionism, anytime there was Zionist agitation, anytime there was publicity about Jews, this was hurting the United States in North Africa and the Middle East. Mm. And the head of the Near Eastern Division of the State Department, Wallace Murray, tried repeatedly to get the United States to back a pro-Arab and pro-British view in the Middle East, and to the point where they wanted to curb the rights of American citizens to protest and voice their opinions, positive opinions about Zionism.
Let me add, everything changes when the war starts. You then get another Roosevelt, the third Roosevelt, who is now preparing the nation for a major program, very expensive one, to aid the Allies, and who probably realizes eventually the United States is going to get into the war. He's faced with tremendous isolationist opposition at home. He's worried about anti-Semitism. And the last thing he wants is to be accused of pushing America into the war for the Jews. So even more than before, he wants to strike common themes. And he also now sharply again restricts refugee immigration to the United States during the war, very worried that maybe Nazi spies or saboteurs might get in, and that would not only be a disaster for U.S. security, but obviously a disaster for the administration politically.
And there was a very interesting juxtaposition, as you mentioned in the book, how German propaganda accused the Roosevelt administration, accused him of being Jewish, the Jew Roosevelt. He was operated and manipulated by Jews. On one hand, they're giving all this divide and conquer propaganda to the American people. And on the other hand, there is a fear promulgated, right or wrong, that German Jewish immigrants could be fifth columnists. They could be pressured by their families being in concentration camps. So there's this situation where the Jews in America are caught in this whiz-bang over public opinion. And, of course, in the last Gallup poll of November 1941, over 90% of the Americans did not want to go to war to save Britain, even. And in similar polls, 47% of American Americans showed a disdain for Jews, an innate distrust of them, and over 90% did not want to lower immigration barriers. We have to go to our last commercial break. You're listening to The Advocates, live streaming on WVOX with my guests, historians Richard Brightman, Alan Lichtman. We're talking about FDR and Jews, the FDR's wartime legacy regarding the Holocaust, immigration, American domestic politics, and always the hot-button, radioactive subject of immigration.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Your Saturday mail delivery is safe for now.
The Postal Service delaying plans for five-day-a-week service because Congress isn't allowing the change. Earlier this year, the Postal Service announced it would end Saturday mail delivery in August as one way to cut costs.
Fox Radio's Jared Halper in the Post Office says the roadblock is the latest spending bill from Congress, which prohibits any reduction in delivery days. There's a compromise on gun control in the Senate.
We have an agreement on an amendment to prevent criminals and the mentally ill and insane from getting firearms and harming people.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and Republican Pat Toomey out with a plan to expand background checks. And the president sent Congress a $3.8 trillion spending blueprint. Next year's budget aimed at tackling the deficit. It would also raise taxes on the wealthy and trim Social Security and other benefits programs. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Time to pay some immediate attention to the trees on your property. But who do you call? Well, for almost 30 years in this county, smart homeowners have relied on the Mancuso family's Manor Tree Company. In every season of the year, Manor Tree, based in Pelham Manor, New York, has been the preeminent tree specialist for individual neighborhood homeowners and for the discerning proprietors of the great estates of Westchester as well. Business and commercial owners also know about Manor Tree for tree removal, stump grinding, pruning, shaping, even for quality, clean-burning fireplace wood. A free inspection of your property by Manor Tree Company right now can help protect your beautiful and valuable trees all year long. We invite you to call for a consultation in Pelham Manor, 914-738-1785. That's Manor Tree Company, 738-1785. They're the best you can find in Westchester.
What a weekend it's going to be for golf. The Masters and the Metro Golf Show both return. Hi, I'm Tom Merriam. Join Bill Meth and me this Saturday morning at 8 o'clock here on WVOX, 1460 AM, and WVOX.com as the Metro Golf Show tees off its 11th season. We'll feature on-the-scene coverage from the Masters in Augusta and have a special look at America's most fabled golf course with broadcast legend Dick Enberg. Plus, we'll have our first tip of the week for our new season, a new stop on the Metro Golf Show Tour, and the premiere of Rules of the Game, where you'll learn the fine points of the rules with Gene Westmoreland of the Metropolitan Golf Association. You'll get all that and even more this Saturday and every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock on what the New York Daily News calls the best local radio show covering golf, the Metro Golf Show on WVOX and WVOX.com. Tune us in before you tee off this Saturday morning at 8 on WVOX.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of the Davis School, Congregation Anshe Shalom, Dr. David Brindell, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
We're the king of spring.
That doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I know, but it rhymes. Give me a break. VOX.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guests, Professor Richard Brightman, Alan Lichtman. We've been discussing their book, FDR and the Jews, their view of FDR's wartime legacy regarding the Holocaust, immigration, isolationism, and rescue of hundreds of thousands of Jews. In our last segment, and time is of course limited, three of the most controversial issues that emerged as the war started to reverse against Nazi Germany in the wake of their losses at El Alamein, Stalingrad, North Africa, and Sicily. These issues were the bombing of Auschwitz, the plight of the Hungarian Jews in 1944, and the meeting with FDR and Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia. Gentlemen, isn't it true that Auschwitz, according to Martin Gilbert and Lucy Davidovits, two renowned experts on the Holocaust, was not known as a death camp until millions of Jews had been killed? It was too far to be effectively bombed, and that railroad lines could hardly be hit by heavy level bombers without being immediately repaired. Is this so?
To a degree. We know more than we knew when Martin Gilbert and Lucy Davidovits were writing. So some information about Auschwitz did leak out through the Polish underground and other means. And there were certainly some people in Britain and the United States who knew, not all of them believed it, but who knew about factory-style killing at Auschwitz. But it wasn't common knowledge. Mm. It wasn't even well known to the major Jewish organizations. We found a minutes of a meeting between some of the leading American Jews and John Pele, the head of the War Refugee Board. None of the participants at that meeting called for the Allies to bomb the gas chambers and crematoria at Auschwitz. Now, could it have been done? That's the issue that people always say, the kind of retrospective view. And we do know that once the Allies had conquered a portion of southern Italy, there was a good air base at Foggia,
right,
that they could have gone more than 1,000 kilometers each way to Auschwitz. And in fact, they did send some bombers to bomb strategic targets.
Monowitz, the Monowitz synthetic oil plant that was next to it.
Yes.
Now, quick question here. David Ben-Gurion and his committee in Jerusalem, they voted. They were asked about this late in the game also. They voted 11-1 against bombing the death camps because they felt it would kill Jews. Were they uninformed that this was the terminus or what?
Look, you can get a fight over that particular document because there are later meetings and there are other views. The head of the World Jewish Congress Rescue Operation, a man named Kubovitsky, was also opposed to it. From, a distant 21st century perspective, we can look at this and say, you know, if they had succeeded, it would have been a good thing to do because it would have cut down the efficiency of the killing. At the time, the people who were pushing this were not people who were particularly influential politically. And the issue never reached Franklin Roosevelt. That was the most important thing. Everyone has the impression that Roosevelt turned this down. The guy who turned it down was the Assistant Secretary of War, John J. McCloy, and his own biographer said there's no evidence that it ever went beyond him.
Now, they said that the Norden bomb site would allow a B-17 to drop a bomb into a pickle barrel. Now, we know that's untrue. We know that could hardly get 500 feet to a pickle barrel. How could these bombers bomb from 10 to 20 to 30,000 feet, mostly about 20,000 feet, a single rail line and hit it? And if it did hit it, if there was massive carpet bombing, don't you think the Germans could repair rail lines, especially to kill Jews?
The War Refugee Board did investigate the idea of bombing rail lines because it didn't involve killing Jewish prisoners. And they came back with the conclusion that this was pointless, that the Germans could repair rail lines in a day and sometimes less than a day. And you couldn't go to the War Department and ask American planes to and pilots to risk their lives for a mission like this.
Well, yeah, and remember also, marshalling yards that were bombed were repaired by 50 to 100,000 German workers over a weekend. literally. That's the marshalling yard where you could hit it by massive bombing. This was proven all over Western Europe. You know, FDR warned the Hungarian government regarding the fate of 725,000 Jews that were still in Germany, not all of them Hungarians. What happened to those Jews, and could they, any of them, really be saved? What about the warnings, and what about the Hungarian government, and who pushed the Hungarians to cooperate with the final transportation?
Okay, this is related to the issue of bombing Auschwitz, and I'll try to squeeze everything in because I know time is tight. The proposals for bombing Auschwitz came at a time when Hungarian Jews were being deported at a fearsome rate. By the time that the War Department rejected it, the first phase of deportations of Hungarian Jews was almost done, despite the fact that the American government had been repeatedly warning Hungarian leaders not to do this and broadcast warnings to or appeals to Hungarian citizens to help hide Jews. When an American bomber accidentally bombed Budapest in early July, the ruler of Hungary came to the conclusion that the Americans were quite serious about punishing Hungary,
right,
and he suspended the deportations. That wasn't the only factor. There were others, but that was certainly a major factor. And so as a result of a three-month hiatus in from July until the fall, more than 100,000 Jews of Budapest were able to survive the Holocaust.
Right. Now, let's talk quickly. We're running down in time. Yalta. Post-Yalta, FDR meets with Ibn Saud on the cruiser USS Quincy. What did FDR offer the Saudis regarding Palestine, Jewish homeland? What did he learn?
FDR continued to believe that the Saudis would listen to reason and the promise of American economic aid. And he talked about what we call the Holocaust and what had happened to the Jews in Europe, and he appealed to Ibn Saud to support allowing a major Jewish immigration into Palestine. FDR's view of the Middle East for the post-war period was a Middle East of independent states, and at that time not all of them were, and he believed that Palestine should become a Jewish state, and he wanted to get Saudi support for this, and he hit an absolute stone wall.
Oh, right. Right. And you're 100% right. History says that the Saudis Saud answered that they were a Bedouin people. They didn't need immigration, irrigation. They didn't want this intervention. In fact, his language was much rougher, much more anti-Semitic, much more brutal. And when FDR goes home and he speaks about this issue in his speech and talks about the issue of Zionism in this, he says, I learned more in 5 minutes from Saud than I learned from all the Zionists. And what he's saying is he doesn't believe what Saud. He's learning that they're not going to cooperate.
He was worried that there was going to be a war if a Jewish state were proclaimed.
And he was right.
And he was right.
Right. You know, we're our last issue is the War Refugee Board. We're running down in time. We got a minute. Was it too little and too late? And of the 6 million Jews lost in the Holocaust, how many were saved directly or indirectly by FDR's efforts? And were there realistically much more than could be saved? What's your quick thoughts? We got about 30 seconds.
We calculated that the War Refugee Board helped to save approximately 200,000 people. And yes, they could have done better if the board had been established earlier because the State Department was mishandling the issues. But you can't slight the fact that 200,000 people were saved, and our record against later genocides is not so good by comparison.
Mm. It's very interesting. I just want to applaud you two for a very balanced view of a very, very difficult issue. Measuring what tremendous congressional opposition there was, the State Department. You can't fire the whole State Department. There were careerists there. There were people there. Yes, I think your analysis of the first term of what FDR had to deal with, the economic circumstances, and his second term. And I want to thank you both for joining me today and having a most interesting and enlightening hour. And I recommend to all to read FDR and the Jews. I think it talks about the situation so importantly and correctly. And thank you for joining me today.
thank you very much for having us.
My pleasure. You know, if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, where information on my guests will be posted. They have a lot of background on this. I just want to mention to my audience, like to be upfront, is I've had a lifelong interest in in FDR and his administration regarding his work, and I own over 400 books on FDR, the New Deal, and his family. And I appreciate Professors Brightman and Lichtman for putting the record straight on so many issues. I'll be back in 2 weeks with Dr. Toby Jenkins. We'll be discussing cultural differences, race, and young people's perception today of what these views are. And they're a lot different from the old-timers like myself. Again, thank you very much. Have a great day. And please look for FDR and the Jews. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460 WVOX. The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX.
Love this time of year, don't you?
I love spring.
I love it.
Thanks for spending your spring with AM 1460 WVOX New Rochelle and WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Brady.
If we want to keep rebuilding our economy on a stronger, more